for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. At the height of the civil rights movement in the Deep South, white socialites and their black maids spent their days together but lived in different worlds. For our readers' review this month, we're going to talk about a fictionalized account of what happens when women of different races start a movement of their own to change their town and the way mothers, daughters, caregivers, and friends view one another. The book is titled The Help by Catherine Stockett. And joining us here in the studio to talk about the novel is the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon. She is the retired Episcopal Bishop of Washington, poet E. Ethelbert Miller, and Natalie Hopkinson of TheRoot.com. I hope you'll join us as well. As I've said, this is a best-selling novel. I know many of you have read it. We're going to open the phones early today so that you can join in as we talk about the series of episodes in Catherine Stockett's book, The Help. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
It's good to have you here. Jane Dixon, I think that this book appealed very strongly to you personally. Tell us why.
It did, Diane. I read it this summer. A friend gave it to me who had been at a book signing party with Catherine Stockett and sent it to me. I couldn't put it down because it is a story of my life in Mississippi, from whence I come. Interestingly enough, I did read it and put it down. And when your producer called and asked if I would be on the show a couple of months ago, I had to reread it because I had literally repressed so much of it. I found that this book convicted me of the life that I led growing up in Mississippi.
Say more about that.
Well, I am about the age of the white woman, Skeeter, in this book. I graduated from college in 1959. I did not return to Mississippi to live. I lived in Nashville after graduating from Vanderbilt. But I well know this world. We were blessed in our home to have a woman who worked for us for years and years, Julia Tolliver. And I think what convicted me the most was I've never had a chance to talk to her. She was murdered in the summer of 1961. I had married in 1960 and moved away from there. So she and I never had a chance to talk after my life changed and became aware of the really terrible conditions that we white folk imposed on our African-American brothers and sisters.
Ethelbert, how did you react to this story?
Well, I looked at this book on a number of levels. First, I saw this book as a book about two women who want to be writers in Jackson, Mississippi, one old, one young, one black, one white. And I saw these two women finding their voice. So that was one of the things that was the first thing that jumped out at me. And then I saw this book as being a book about secrets. Almost every character is hiding something, and as we know, that secrets are eventually shared privately as well publicly, you know. But this is a book about secrets. Then I felt the backdrop was good in terms of this is a early civil rights movement. So the events behind these character stories is the, you know, March on Washington is going to take place, Medgar Evers' slaying, which is very important, and also what I'm glad was mentioned was the fact that right after King's March and the March on Washington, you have the bombing in Birmingham. And I think that when you look at those events and the impact it has on black people, especially older black people, that's the change. What is very interesting is that Howard Zinn just died, noted historian. And I think that when you look at Zinn talking about people making history, the people in this book, The Help, these are the people who are the backbone of the civil rights movement. You know, I mean, and you see this slow changing consciousness, mm-hmm. and I think Ms. Skeeter is a witness to that mm-hmm. in terms of these, you know, these people surprise her in terms of what they're willing to do mm-hmm. and in terms of the quiet courage.
And Natalie, you, the youngest on this panel, how did you react to the book?
Well, for me, I am 33, and so I've never known legally enforced segregation. I went to Howard University by choice, and I don't know, it's mostly foreign to me. And so it really brought to vivid life what a lot of the rationale was. Like, I mean, I feel pretty ignorant, but I did not realize that segregation of bathrooms, it was seen as a sanitation issue. You know, I thought that they just held a grudge and just didn't want to be around them. But it, you know, it really sort of brought to life this idea that Black people were seen as livestock. They're seen as something less than human. You cannot use the same bathroom as them because it's a sanitation issue. And that was the big storyline throughout the book. And so, you know, it really added a whole new dimension for me and my understanding of what segregation was about and what the rationale was for it. Like the thought that someone would see them as less than human happily is so foreign to me that, you know, it really took this book to kind of bring it to life.
Natalie Hopkinson, she's media and culture critic for TheRoot.com. That's the Washington Post Black Interest web magazine. She's co-author of Deconstructing Tyrone, a new look at Black masculinity in the hip-hop generation, and the forthcoming book, Go Go Live. And if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jane Dixon, as Natalie talked about the construction of that separate bathroom, I was so horrified reading that this central character in the book was relegated to a bathroom outside the house to which she had to walk through the rain to get to.
Well, it's real, Diane. The woman I just spoke about, Julia Tolliver, who was such a central figure in my life, had to do that. At our house, there was a different house in the back that was called the servants' quarters. It was a house that had a bedroom and a bathroom, and that's what she used. My brother, who's a medical doctor who lives in California, called me about 2 weeks ago. He was reading the book, and I said to him, "Was that really what happened for Julia?" He said, "Of course, Jane." He said, "You just don't choose to remember that." But that's where she went to the bathroom when she was at. She did not live at our house. She had her own home, but she was there 7 days a week.
But one of the central characters, a white woman, decides that this is the only sanitary way for the Black maids to dwell within the white homes, even a separate set of dishes.
Well, you know, whenever you look at how groups have interacted, whether it's Black and whites, whether it's Asian, white, usually the other is conceived as someone who has a disease, even down to how sometimes we label things, Asian flu, you know. So, you know, you have a concern about anybody who's from Asia, whether they sneeze on you. Or you could go back a few years ago where, you know, if someone was from Haiti, you felt they had AIDS. And so what happens, you look up and we begin to exclude people because we feel the others have a disease. And we justify that with laws. And then the laws separate people.
So you had separate drinking fountains. Exactly. You had separate bathrooms. I mean, that's on the public level.
And that's the fear, too.
But here we are in a private home.
Well, my father was a medical doctor in this town where we lived and had a hospital. And there was the Black wing of the hospital, and there was the white wing of the hospital. He did use the same operating room for everyone. But the fact is, when folks stayed, they stayed in separate facility.
Interesting. Here is an early email from Dinah in Dallas. She says, this is the best description she's heard of this book, how cruel and how kind women can be to each other. And it is Skeeter Phelan who is that woman who is trying to reach out to try to understand the reality of these black women's, the help, lives.
Yeah, and I actually, you know, I'm a black woman, but I found myself really relating to Skeeter a lot. I worked for the Washington Post as a reporter for many years, and one of the most vivid scenes for me was when Skeeter was trying to convince one of the maids to participate in this book.
And describe the book.
Well, she decided it was sort of a ethnographic look at maids in a fictional town in Mississippi. And so she was promised them anonymity, but she had to recruit all of these maids to share their stories. And the first maid that she approached, you know, the way Catherine Stockett did such a good job of describing how inconceivable it was for Abilene to participate in this. You know, like, it, in me as a journalist, I'm for, you know, disclosure, sharing, giving people voices. And, you know, I found myself on Abilene's side, like, no, do not talk to this woman. You know, don't do it.
Why?
Well, because you have so much to lose. You know, it seems, you know, again, from my perspective, you know, having a voice, I mean, this is the time of everyone has a voice, you know, the era
but
that we're living
then,
in now.
But not then.
Back then, it was very revolutionary and very powerful to be able to just tell what your story was.
The book we're talking about is titled The Help by Catherine Stockett, a bestseller. Do join us. Welcome back. For our February Reader's Review, we've chosen Catherine Stockett's bestseller, The Help. I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850. Here in the studio, E. Ethelbert Miller. He's poet, director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University, board chair of the Institute for Policy Study, and author of the forthcoming book, On Saturdays, I Santana With You. Is that the right title?
Yes, that's Santana.
That's interesting, interesting. And the Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon, she is the retired Episcopal Bishop of Washington pro tempore, and Natalie Hopkinson. She's media and culture critic for TheRoot.com. That's the Washington Post Black Interest web magazine. Here's an email from Bob who says, is it just me, or does the book not spell out very well how Skeeter, who is the white woman who gets the whole book project started, does not describe very well how Skeeter becomes self-aware. Even your guest from Mississippi confesses she saw no problems with the world in which she grew up.
I think Skeeter is an amazing character, but you have to remember that she came back to Jackson in 1960, and the 61, I believe, is when the book starts. The stirring has begun there at this time. I was gone by then, and the stirring began for me in Nashville, Tennessee, when the civil rights movement moved from Greensboro, North Carolina, to Nashville. But this is a woman who had that incredible relationship with Constantine, who had worked in their home. And her honest relationship with that woman must have stirred something in me, because I can only attribute the fact that when I did begin to open my eyes, that I went back and remembered the interactions that I had with Julia in my own home, and her talk about Jackie Robinson, who was the big figure for her in the 50s. Dr. King came along. I was in college by then, away from home. So she and I only had very few conversations about Dr. King, but you have to remember Skeeter was in school when Dr. King was very active in Alabama during those days.
And one other thing that you and Skeeter have in common, she never got to talk with Constantine.
That's right.
And nobody told her why Constantine had left, and you never got to talk with Julia.
No, I remember well coming home from an event when my mother called to tell me that she had been murdered the night before. And I will go to my grave regretting that she and I never were able to sit down and talk about all of this. And as my change in life came as the opening and moving to Washington, which was one of the great events, and marrying a man who had just graduated from law school, for whom the Constitution and the Bible were on the bedside table, that she and I could not talk about this and the changes that have come in my life. And I attribute that early awakening to seeing that Christmas card with pictures of black faces on it that she was sending to her friends.
Ah, that's hilarious.
Yeah, I think that she is different because she immediately realizes that she has a dream. She wants to be a writer. That, in the early 60s, makes her different from all the other women. It makes her different from her mother. It makes her different from some of her girlfriends who are going off to college simply find somebody to marry. So that sets her off, okay? That sense of being the writer. Reading Catcher in the Rye, that'll set you off.
Yes, you bet.
You can see she's a little different, and when it gets down to a choice between writing or hooking up with a boyfriend, she's preferring this Lisa's goal. And she's not even clear if she is a writer or whether she simply wants to be an editor.
But she has the courage to reach out to an editor in New York, and by darn, she gets a call back.
Yes, and, you know, that was actually one of my favorite characters in the book. This, was it Elaine Stein?
Elaine, exactly.
Who was this hard-nosed editor who gives her very blunt advice about how she can make it as a writer.
And don't live with your mother.
And that was the thing that, you know, is when you talk about her awakening, I mean, the very cynical part was she was just trying to make a name for herself.
Yeah.
And for those of us who are writers, that is something that we grapple with is, you know, how much is it exploitation? You know, are you just getting people's stories and using them? She's gone off to New York and she's riding off into the sunset when it's all over. But what happens? What is the impact for those maids? Will they lose their job? What is the impact on the words that you're doing?
Abilene knows her job is gone at the end of the book as she walks out that day, that's over for her. And she also knows that she still has to support herself.
And she also knows she is going to be a writer.
She is going to be a writer.
Right. So she has somehow been changed. She knows she's been through something very, very serious, but she is going to become a writer. Let's open the phone so all of you who would like can be part of this program. First to Howell, Michigan. Good morning, Julie. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. First of all, I just want to say how I love your show.
Thank you.
You are plenty to stay-at-home moms. But my book club just finished reading The Help, and we're just a bunch of white women up in Michigan, and we had no idea that these African-American people had to walk such a tightrope in dealing with these jobs. And then the one character that we really liked was the white woman who lived outside of town, who was kind of the trashy outsider.
Yeah.
And how she didn't see a division between the blacks and the whites. She didn't think there was a separation. And then we were also very thankful to the author for having such a gentle ending. I was so afraid that something tragic was going to happen to one of the characters, and I'm so thankful to her for not having a horrible ending.
She tread very, very carefully. I agree with you, Julie. You know, one thing you said brings to mind a question that's been raised a lot, and that is how a white woman could be so bold as to write from a black perspective. How do you feel about that, Natalie?
Well, I have to say, when I, you know, I always look at the author and I look at the author blurb. And so when I knew that this was a white woman who wrote it, I immediately, in the first section, it opens with Abilene's story, which is the black maid. And, you know, I did find myself getting my pencil out and editing her Ebonics because it was, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't.
Yeah.
But to her credit, the characters were so vivid and compelling. I put my pencil away pretty quickly into it. And no, it wasn't perfect, but I think she did a very good job of getting the dialect and you know, Ethelbert, what did you think?
She means well. I say that in terms of, when I first picked it up, that was the first thing. I look at the spelling words and stuff like that, and I had a little problem with that. But then, because I'm reading a lot of manuscripts, a lot of books, I said, okay, let me see where this goes. And it's right. Just like, you know, you blow the first two notes, or you trim the guitar and something else, and then you get it. But I wouldn't want to mention this, because you mentioned about the ending and stuff. I would not want something that's in here, which is key, to be overlooked. The development of the men. I think that the Leroy character, who is married to Minnie, is very important because there is domestic violence here.
Now, you know? Talk about who Minnie is. Talk about Leroy.
Okay. Minnie is another one of the maids. She's one of the maids that pretty much defines this book, because when you get into the whole thing of the rules that the helper is supposed to follow, it is Minnie's mother that explains the seven rules. You know, now you're righteous here, so you know that there's things that spend out in terms of numbers of 7 and 10. and so that's outlined on in the early pages. But what happens is that this is the woman, this is maid, she really has to bite her tongue. She's the one that's sassy. She's, you know, the one that's not going to turn her back. But still, at the same time, her private life
is horrific.
It's terrific. And I think that needs to be really brought up
and
discussed.
She has to bite her tongue because she's lost several jobs. Right. Because she talks back. Right. She simply won't take it. Now, Natalie, I'm going to ask you whether you would be willing to read the opening page of this book to give our listeners a sense. And what I want to remind you of is that the author has said she purposefully used only words that are in the dictionary and not made up words.
Mae Mobley was born on an early Sunday morning in August 1960. A church baby, we like to call it. Taking care of white babies, that's what I do, along with all the cooking and the cleaning. I done raised 17 kids in my lifetime. I know how to get them babies to sleep, stop crying, and go in the toilet bowl before their mamas even get out of bed in the morning. But I ain't never seen a baby yell like Mae Mobley Leifold. First day I walk in the door, there she be, red hot and hollering with the colic, fighting the bottle like it's a rotten turnip. Miss Leifold, she looked terrified at her own child. What am I doing wrong? How can I stop it? That was my first hint. Something is wrong with this situation. So I took that pink screaming baby in my arms, bounced her on my hip, to get the gas moving, and it didn't take 2 minutes before baby girl stopped her crying, got to smiling up at me like she do. But Miss Leifold, she don't pick up her own baby for the rest of the day. I seen plenty of women's get the baby blues after they done birthing. I thought that's what it was. Here's something about Miss Leifold. She not just frowning all the time, she's skinny. Her legs is so spindly. She looked like she done growed them last week. 23 years old, and she lanky as a 14-year-old boy. Even her hair is thin, brown, see-through. She tried to tease it up, but it only make it look thinner. Her face be the same shape as that red devil on the red hot candy box, pointy chin and all. Fact, her whole body be so full of sharp knobs and corners, it's no wonder she can't soothe that baby. Babies like fat, like to bury their face up in your armpit and go to sleep. They like big fat legs too, that I know. By the time she a year old, May Mobley follow me around everywhere I go. 5 o'clock would come around and she be hanging on my Dr. Scholl's shoe, dragging over the floor, crying like I weren't never coming back. Miss Leifold, she'd narrow her eyes at me like I'd done something wrong, unhitch that crying baby off my foot. I reckon that's the risk you run, letting somebody else raise your chillins.
Natalie Hopkinson, she's media and culture critic for TheRoot.com, reading from the first page of Catherine Stockett's book, The Help. It's our reader's review for this month. You read absolutely beautifully. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, did reading it, did the words feel authentic?
No.
They didn't?
They didn't. No, they didn't.
Did they feel authentic to you, Jane Dixon?
Not exactly, no, they didn't.
Why not?
Well, I have a hard time as a white woman reading language that's put in a black context because it doesn't hit me in the right way. Somehow I hear that, and I'd be interesting to hear what my two colleagues here say. It hits me as demeaning.
To
read this put in, you call it
Ebonics? Yes.
That sounds demeaning to me, and I would be interested to see how you react to that.
Yeah, I think what happens is that, you know, we just don't measure this page by page. What we're looking at is in terms of the voice of the character.
The whole thing.
And then also what we're looking at is in terms of the depth of the characters that the author creates.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Benjamin in Daytona Beach, Florida. Good morning to you, sir. Go right ahead.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment about this book. It's very focused on the women and the main character, or one of the main characters, Skeeter. I wanted to ask how everyone felt about this book if it was told with a male lead character, and males were the, I guess, primary focus, how that would be different in the context and time that the book is told, and how things might not have, how they might not, male characters might not have become as self-aware as easily because of all the gender notions of connected to race and all of that during that time.
Interesting question. You know, one of the people we invited on this program who could not come was Vernon Jordan, who himself lived this life. He said he was a caddy, he was a chauffeur, he had all kinds of less than sterling jobs in his own mind. But what's your reaction?
You know, soon you could go back to Ntozake Shange's For Colored Girls. Once you bring in the male voice, the story is different. And so it's no longer a woman's story. I think when I look at how even the characters in this book are struggling to become writers, they go to a newspaper and it's all men, you know, the women are trying to find their voice. What happens is that we can look at a ton of books, you know, the male voice is always centered, okay? What I do feel is that, you know, the male characters are here are very interesting in terms of what they represent. They represent power in terms of Senate. They represent power in terms of Leroy and his household. He's controlling it. And then it's very interesting that in the case of Leroy and Minnie, they work for the same family. You're saying, you know, I mean, there's a very interesting thing in terms of you don't see them coming home talking about their work.
About what they've done.
But if Leroy begins to talk about that, that changes this book. Because now it's not about the maid. It's somebody who's working outside the house. This takes us inside the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's another reason why this is very powerful because it is told from the point of view of women who, as Ethelbert said, were the foot soldiers in the civil rights movement who didn't often get a voice. They were never front and center, and they quietly toiled and donated. They are the ones who donate to church, who raise the babies, raise their own babies, raise the white women's babies. And, you know, it's really, if you really want to get, well, you know, I'm biased, but, you know, if you really want to get to the humanity of any situation, you know, look at the home. Look whose hand is rocking the cradle. And, you know, that's why, it was such a revolutionary thing for them to attempt to even publish the book. You know, that's just, it shows that how, you know, how even today it's still, you know, people are still looking for that male voice. And, you know, women should have a voice as well.
Natalie Hopkinson, E. Ethelbert Miller, and Jane Dixon will take just a short break. More of your calls when we come back. Join us on 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By Jeffrey Kenner, in appreciation of NPR's international coverage and its foreign correspondents. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with actor William Hurt about his work and his life.
You know, sometimes I'm an actor caught in a movie star's body.
He stars in the new film The Yellow Handkerchief as an ex-con in post-Katrina Louisiana. Join us.
And we are talking about the book, The Help, a novel by Catherine Stockett on the bestseller list. It's a portrayal of Jackson, Mississippi in the early 60s when the civil rights movement was really just getting off the ground. Here is an email from Cheryl who says, "One of the things that really makes me crazy about this, can't live with them and couldn't ride the bus next to them, however they would let their slaves breastfeed them. You don't get any closer to a person than that." How'd you react to that?
You know, and that was one of the reasons why I just thought that colored water fountains were just a grudge, because I'm like, how you are very intimate if you're having she's a wet nurse. I don't understand that. But I actually am just finished another book called Wench that talked about it was in the period of slavery. And the house slave in this book was not allowed to nurse her child because she had to be sent out to the slave quarters to do it. So, you know, again, to me, it really reinforces this idea of, like, this is livestock. This is not a human being that you're talking about. And so you can have, you know, them drink cow's milk. you know, and it's something that's not quite the same intimate, loving experience that we think about breastfeeding as today.
Here's another perspective from Susie in Grand Rapids, who says, I'm a Caucasian woman from the North. Did anyone else find this book trite, predictable, and above all, presumptuous? The author was ill-advised to pursue such a premise. From the reviews it got, I thought it could change my life, but it annoyed me to tears. I should have put it down, but I kept waiting for it to get better. Give me Toni Morrison any day. What's your reaction to that, Ethelbert?
Well, it's good that there's a Toni Morrison in the world as well as a Catherine Steiger. You know, I mean, what you have is a different read. I mean, right there you could see the reason why there was a civil war. You know, different parts of the country see things different way. I mean, I could pick up something about California and think it's trite. You know, I could pick up, well, this is NPR. I shouldn't say pull out certain states. somebody be calling. What do you mean, Ethelbert? We'll meet you in Nevada. You know what I'm saying? But what I'm saying is that, you know, this is one of the challenges in terms of the American story.
And bridging the gap.
And so what you hope is that, you know, writers undertake, discover stories that have not been told, present them. Maybe you'll hear another story. Maybe, you know, Abilene will have her own book, you know, and so that goes on from there. And so, you know, I think it has a lot to do with what a reader brings to the text and what are the expectations.
Here's an email which says, it's from Claire in Dallas. I absolutely loathe this book and am surprised your guests are finding that much to like about it. I'm a middle-aged white female reader. I found the dialect distinctly uncomfortable. I found the characters to be extremely stock, flat players, use saintly maids, evil junior leaguers, clueless men, a brave white woman, the list goes on. I thought Minnie was the only well-rounded character in the book since her life was written with ups and downs. She was a mixture of good and bad, shades of gray, as most people are.
Well, I found Skeeter torn. She eventually goes to New York, but she is torn there in the end when she is with the man who has proposed to her, and when he comes and puts the ruby ring on the couch, and whether she's going to stay in that world and have the marriage that her mother has prayed for and hoped for and worked for.
Because he's a rich white man.
Everything. So I find her. The interesting thing, Diane, is that my daughter-in-law, who's a medical doctor in Vermont, a native of England, went to Mississippi for the first time this summer for a family wedding. She comes back and reads this book, and it opens the world in which I grew up and the world in which her husband spent many summers in the 60s and 70s visiting his grandparents. Her book club has just gotten through reading. Unfortunately, she couldn't be there the night that they talked about this book. But instead of for her being flat and stock, this opened a world to her that she had never known.
Now, let's put Toni Morrison aside. This is a first novel. All the things of the comments that were made, we could raise that for first novels. But then let's bring somebody else into the equation. B.B. Moore Campbell, Your Blues Ain't Like Mine. First novel, a little earlier in terms of the 1950s. Her depiction, I think, of her white characters are exceptional in that book. You know, and that's a first novel. If I was, for example, giving out the Penn Faulkner Award, I probably would go with B.B. Moore Campbell over Catherine Stockett as first novelist. You know, but I saw when I came across how she dealt with the benefit, I said, okay, here's an author having a problem in terms of, okay, I've got to bring all these characters together. How do I do it?
Indeed. Let's go to Hedgeville, West Virginia. Good morning, Jim. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make a couple of observations that I saw personally. My uncle lived in Jackson, Mississippi. As a matter of fact, he was the mayor from 1968 to 1976. His name was Russell Davis. And in 1960, he was also the Hinds County representative. And I know that when my grandmother and I, we'd take a drive down there, and he would literally brag about how little they pay the housemaid, I think it was like $5 a week or something like that. And which, you know, to us, you know, we were from the Washington, D.C. area. That was just, that would infuriate my grandmother. And she would admonish my uncle terribly for paying his hired help so little. And I can also remember one other time we went to Howard Johnson's out there for a dinner. And after we had a black waiter. And after the dinner was over, for a tip, they left the man a quarter. So, I mean, it's very true. I have not read the book. I'll guarantee you I'm going to read it now. But it was bad in those days. And I think anybody, be they white or black, that writes anything from there, that experience, I'm pretty sure is right on the level with it.
Jim, I'm glad you called. Any comments?
Natalie and I were talking about how much we get paid.
We're like, yes, my help is very cheap as well.
Yeah. All right, to Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, Nate. You're on the air.
Good morning. I did read this book, and I thought it was I realize that some people think it's a trite book, but I think that when you look at the efforts that were made in the 60s, and I was born in Alabama, and I'm a 60-year-old guy now and live in the North. But, you know, it took some white people with courage to make that happen. It didn't just all happen because black people were marching. And I thought that Sackett wrote a brilliant book. I think her descriptions of some of the things that not even are the major subjects were done in a very, very well. I think she's a good writer, a very descriptive writer.
I think you're absolutely right. What do you think?
Yeah, and I mean, I would say, and I love Toni Morrison, of course, but it's, you know, I think this is one of the pluses about this book. It was very accessible. You know, you could have many very revolutionary ideas in your book, deep philosophical issues that you're dealing with, but if people can't understand what you're saying, you know, it's sort of is the tree falling in the forest. Yeah. And, you know, this is something that anybody could come to it. It was an easy read. You can sort of zip through. And to me, it accomplished what you want a good novel to accomplish, which is, you know, opening up a world to you or giving you a new way to look at a world that you already know, as Reverend Dixon talked about.
I think what you find her doing, I think she listens well. I mean, you see the character, you know, doing that. And I think that's what Sackett is. She's developed a good ear in terms of listening to these stories. And probably it began when she was very young.
She's got to really, I think, as Nate says, have a lot of courage to pursue a book from this perspective.
I have great admiration for what she did. I think to open this up, as you say, in an accessible way, and if somebody like you could understand that what many white, I'm not saying all this is a total, I have to be careful, it's not a generalization, but there were many white people who considered African-American people lesser forms of humanity than they were. That's true. I know that's true. And if it could open that up and why there were black bathrooms and black water fountains, it's because of fear of disease, then she has done something that I hope my grandchildren are going to read and understand what was. And we always know that history can go back to things. I mean, if anybody looks at Civil War history and what happened with the Emancipation Proclamation, Reconstruction, and then what happened with Jim Crow laws, we know that history can repeat itself if we don't understand what needs to be understood. So I think she has helped a lot of people understand the reality of what was.
Let's go to Montgomery, Alabama. Good morning, Sue. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I'm from Montgomery, but I'm living in Tuscaloosa now. And Diane, I love your show.
Thank you.
I was going to address a few things. One, I've read the book in a book club, and I thought it was excellent for what it was trying to do. I think that she was speaking to Southern white women and trying to open the eyes of some people who are still asleep. And I don't think that the dialect was necessarily excellent, although as a white woman, 71, it didn't offend me, but I did find that it wasn't as accurate as what I have experienced. But I did feel that that she was writing to try to expose something. And I also, I listened to some other people on the air, I experienced the thing of people paying only $5 a week. And my mother-in-law at one point in New Orleans paid $8 a week, which was very high, but I was embarrassed to have a maid that I didn't pay more than that. But back to the book, the prejudice, how the question about how did the author overcome her prejudice or how did she open her eyes, from my experience, all it took was one or two experiences of extreme prejudice to say, what is all of this about? And I think that could have happened with her. Also, her father, in the book, it indicated that he was just with his help and that he would have never allowed something as unjust to happen to any of his workers, his black workers, as some things that were happening in the area.
I think that's a really good point you make, Sue Ethelberg.
Yeah, I was just talking about the whole thing of courage in terms of crossing the line. You know, this is taking place at a time in which we saw people who were, like, say, for example, in SNCC or dealing with voter registration coming into the South. There was a risk for her to be going over to the black neighborhood at a certain particular time. You know, this one.
I was scared to death every single time she did.
And you know, when you get a knock on the door, you don't know who it is and things of that sort. And then that's the violence, I think, from between 1954 into the early 60s. If you document the level of violence, or terrorism, if you really want to call it, it's real. And I think it takes a courageous person to pursue this type of book.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. One of the most touching scenes toward the end of the book is when Mae Mobley starts realizing that her beloved maid is going to leave. Jane, would you read that for us?
Mae Mobley runs out in her nightie, and she stops in front of me. She hiccuping and crying, and her little nose is red as a rose. Her mama must have told her I'm leaving. God, I pray, tell me she didn't repeat Miss Hilly's lies. Baby girl grabbed my skirt on my uniform and don't let it go. I touch my hand to her forehead, and she burning with fever. Baby, you need to get back in the bed. No, she bawls. Don't go, Abby. Miss Leifold come out of the bedroom frowning, holding little man. Abby, he calling out, grinning. Hey, little man, I whisper. I'm so glad he don't understand what's going on. Miss Leifold, let me take her in the kitchen and give her some medicine. Her fever is real high. Miss Leifold glance at Miss Hilly, but she's just sitting there with her arms crossed. All right, go on, Miss Leifold say. I take baby girl's hot little hand and lead her into the kitchen. She bark out that scary cough again, and I get the baby aspirin and the cough syrup. Just being in here with me, she calmed down some, but tears is still running down her face. I put her up on the counter and crush up a little pink pill, mix it with some applesauce, and feed her the spoonful. She swallow it down, and I know it hurts her. I smooth her hair back. That clump of bangs she cut off with her construction scissors is growing back, sticking straight out. Miss Leifold can't hardly look at her lately. Please don't leave, Abby, she's saying, starting to cry again. I got to, baby. I'm so sorry. And that's when I start to cry. I don't want to. It's just going to make it worse for her, but I can't stop. Why? Why don't you want to see me anymore? Are you going to take care of another little girl? Her forehead is all wrinkled up, just like when her mama fuss at her. Law, I feel like my heart's going to bleed to death. I take her face in my hands, feeling the scary heat coming off her cheeks. No, baby, that's not the reason. I don't want to leave you. But how do I put this? I can't tell her I'm fired. I don't want her to blame her mama and make it worse between them. It's time for me to retire. You my last little girl, I say, because this is the truth. It just ain't going to be by my own choosing. I let her cry a minute on my chest, and then I take her face into my hands again. I take a deep breath, and I tell her to do the same. Baby girl, I say, I need you to remember everything I told you. Do you remember what I told you? She's still crying already, but the hiccups is gone. To wipe my bottom good when I'm gone? No, baby, the other. What about what you are? I look deep into her rich brown eyes, and she look into mine. Law, she got old soul eyes like she done lived 1,000 years. And I swear I see, down inside, the woman she gone grown up to be, a flash from the future. She is tall and straight. She is proud. She got a better haircut, and she is remembering the words I put in her head, remembering as a full-grown woman. And then she say it just like I need her to. You is kind, she say. You is smart. You is important. Oh, law, I hug her hot little body to me. I feel like she done just given me a gift. Thank you, baby girl.
The Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon. She is, in fact, the Right Reverend. She is the retired Episcopal Bishop of Washington. She has just read from the ending of The Help. I hope you've enjoyed our reader's review of Catherine Stockett's book with E. Ethelbert Miller and Natalie Hopkinson. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
And I want you to know that for our next reader's review, we'll bring you the story of a passionate young woman, her cowardly lover, and her aging, vengeful husband, The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Hope you join us. Thanks for listening today. I'm Diane Reed.